Dogs come in all sizes and shapes, but the vast majority of them have one job, keeping us company, and they're very good at it. But some dogs have careers of their own, the working dogs who guide us, hear for us, or find things for us. We'll stick with that third category today. Our guest is the owner of a working dog, a German Shepherd whose job is to find dead bodies, a cadaver dog. He and the science of working dogs are the subject of the book, What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. Kat Warren is its author. She's a science journalist and associate professor at North Carolina State University, teaching science journalism, editing, and reporting. And yes, she and her husband own two dogs, both German Shepherds. Kat Warren, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it's really a pleasure to be here, and it was wonderful listening to the weather report since I grew up in Oregon and lived in Northern California. So
I wanted to ask you about that regional connection, yes.
Yes, it brought me back. I spent my childhood in Corvallis and then was in Eugene for a number of years and in Portland, and So it was great hearing the weather report.
Oh, good! I'm glad you enjoyed it. The dogs you have are Coda and Solo. We meet Solo early. With this great line, Solo smells the departed.
Yes. Solo is coming on 10 years old now, and I started working with him, training him when he was 4.5 months old. So it's been a while. Dog's life flip past so quickly that it's just hard to believe that he's coming on 10.
Wow, that is, we get to know him from a very early age. He has a career separate from yours. I mean, tell us about this process, though. I mean, how do you know that a dog is going to be good at something like being a cadaver dog versus, for example, a bomb-sniffing dog, drug-sniffing dog, what are the other sniffing dogs out there? I mean, what makes the determination that, for example, Sola will become a cadaver dog?
Well, I mean, the determination was made for me quite accidentally by a trainer where I took him as a pup to her because he was a bit of a problem as a youngster. He was out of control, and I was trying to figure out how to work effectively with him. And she suggested this particular kind of work, not because his nose is better designed to sniff out the dead than, say, drugs, because a dog who's trained can detect almost any scent you want to train it for, but mostly because I was teaching and at NC State, and part of the advantage of having a cadaver dog is that it's, first of all, a volunteer position. Secondly, there's a need for it. This is not the kind of dog that most police departments can sort of afford to keep on staff. And thirdly, I hate to say this, but the dead can wait, mostly. And so you can schedule when you go out to do a search. I know you don't put it off for a couple of weeks, but you can make it. You can say, hey, I can be there in 3 hours, rather than dropping everything and racing to the site.
Right, in the sense that he's not looking for people who are trapped and still alive.
That's exactly right. And very often, anyone who's familiar with North Carolina weather, during the summer, for instance, a mid-afternoon in the summer search is not ideal for a dog when you're dealing with high humidity and temperatures in the 90s and sometimes in the hundreds. So, being able to say, let's come out first thing in the morning can be a huge advantage.
Solo's job must be a really interesting conversation starter, because when people admire him, you'll say, oh, he's a working dog. Really, what does he do? Well, he finds dead bodies. So where does the conversation usually go from there?
Well, it goes two ways. Ew, in which case I changed the topic, or wow, that's really fascinating. In which case, depending on whether we're sitting around the dinner table or having a drink or somewhere else, I'll take the conversation as far as it needs to go to be really frank without grossing somebody out. But you really do, you have that range. There are certainly people where the entire idea freaks them out, and so we do change the subject at that point.
Solo's name makes sense as soon as we find out about his birth. I mean, how rare is it for a singleton to be born?
Well, depending on the breed, it's not all that rare. A lot of toy dogs have such tiny wombs that some of the toy breeds typically have very small litters and sometimes only one. In this particular case, this was a artificial insemination that didn't go well, and the result was shepherds usually have, you know, between 4 and 10 pups in the litter. He was the only one. He was beautiful, in great shape, but singleton pups often come with problems. And those problems have to do with the fact that litters are really good at socializing each other to be good with other dogs. And Solo didn't get that.
Socialized with other dogs before he gets socialized with humans, and all that stuff that that comes with that. We'll learn much more about Solo's upbringing and what he was like as a puppy and what he turned into as an adult dog in the book What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs, as written by Kat Warren. We'll come back and talk more with Kat and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kat Warren, science journalist, university professor, and dog owner. Her dog is a working dog, a cadaver dog. He finds dead bodies. And we learn more about the education of Solo and his uses and other working dogs as well in the book What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, Kat Warren and I, at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we talked about the fact that Solo was a singleton. He was born pretty much without a litter. Well, not pretty much. He was born without a litter. He was the only dog. So what sorts of behaviors, when you have to compete and hang around all these other furry bodies, did he miss out on? And what changes does that produce in a puppy who doesn't have other puppies around him?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of great research out there that shows, but what we know anecdotally is that singleton pups can be dog aggressive because they just don't know how to interact in a easygoing way with other dogs, because little pups in the litter give each other just all these thousands of signals, including, you know, when I bite too hard, the other pup is going to get upset and is going to bite me back. And pups learn how to ease up on how hard they bite each other. They learn how to, in a sense, be easygoing. It's like a puppy diplomacy course. And a lot of people I know who are breeders, when this happens, they will actually try to find another litter to put the pup with if that litter is somewhere around the same age. So I had a responsible breeder. She looked all around. She couldn't find another litter. And so Solo missed out on that part of his education. And what you have with singletons is sometimes you have dog-aggressive dogs, or sometimes you have dogs that can be people-aggressive as well, because they're just missing that socialization gene. That wasn't his problem. He was enormously attached to people from the get-go. And over time, he's become much better. Early on, he was flunking out of puppy classes, and I was experienced in training obedience dogs, but I had never handled a dog that had so much energy and intelligence, and then with this particular quirk added. I was feeling pretty discouraged.
You didn't even like Solo very much at the very beginning. Is that true?
There were a few days there. My husband is much more patient and optimistic than I am. There were some nights of tears, and certainly I think every dog owner deals with this. It doesn't matter who the dog is. There are going to be issues. I would say that for a large German Shepherd, that dog aggression can be a kind of overwhelming issue if you don't kind of deal with it up front. And so that's what took me to this trainer when Sola was about 4.5 months old. And that's what sort of led me into this area where I could really take my own education to the next level working with him. So it really was this sort of unfortunate thing that turned into probably one of the neatest things that's ever happened to me.
What early evidence did Solo display of possessing an exceptional nose? I mean, it's not any dog of that same breed who could do what he does, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, most dogs have noses. Most dogs have very good noses. And Solo used his nose almost from the moment he was born. And his breeder noticed this. I had no awareness or appreciation what it meant. But by the time we got him, even though it wasn't something that I even valued, that a dog would have a good nose, I could watch him and see how much more interested he was in using that organ as opposed to his eyes and ears. I mean, and, you know, and so he, early on, he started tracking my husband. When my husband would leave the house, Solo would just have no problem putting his nose to the ground and finding him. And so I knew that he had that, but of course lots of dogs have that. And I didn't ever anticipate that I would actually do something with it. But indeed, that was the outcome when I took him to this trainer and said, what am I going to do? she suggested that he be trained to search for the dead.
And was that because of the things you mentioned earlier, where it was the sort of thing you can actually schedule? There's a little more room for somebody like yourself to own this kind of search dog?
Yes, and, you know, to be frank, I had just, I was in my late 40s at the time, you know, as an academic, so I had thought about search and rescue, but I think that search and rescue is one of those things where a whole lot of stuff has to come together. You have to be enormously physically fit. It's not just a weekend warrior thing. It's something that you have to do very, very seriously. And it's not that the cadaver dog work isn't serious. It is, and it takes an enormous amount of time. But I didn't want somebody who was missing to have to depend on my ability to, you know, run behind a dog for 5 miles. And Solo as a cadaver dog works much more independently from other dogs. And the same is not true when you're deploying a bunch of dogs simultaneously to search for somebody who's possibly still alive.
Before we get into what the cadaver dogs do, I want to go back a little bit because you do provide a good history in what the dog knows, Cat Warren, in explaining dogs and the dead do have a long history. Would you? This is not necessarily for the squeamish either, but can you give us a few examples?
Well, I mean, it's really fascinating. The dog plays such a huge role in our civilization, and every time we think we've gone back to the early days of the dog, archaeologists are finding that it goes back even further. And inevitably, when you have dogs with people, and dogs are probably first started hanging out partly as scavengers around areas, and that role that they played, and of course we had wild dogs and jackals, and if you think about the Egyptians making Anubis, the dog jackal, into a god, that was because these dogs ate people once they died, right? And it was an important role in, you know, agrarian societies that were becoming less agrarian, that you have dogs fulfilling that function. And, you know, people looked around and saw that dogs could eat the dead and not worry about all the demons that were haunting the dead. And, you know, inevitably it was sort of like, well, let's make them into gods, because obviously they're not scared of the demons around dead people. And so there was this thing where it was both, as you say, something not for the squeamish, but simultaneously they fulfilled a real function. And so I think that even though cadaver dogs as a kind of profession didn't come into being until the 70s, it's been known for thousands of years that dogs are pretty good at finding stuff, right?
Right.
And it can be a dead animal or it can be a dead human.
Right. It doesn't really matter what it is for that matter. All right. We get into the quality of dog noses. And let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Kat Warren, the author of What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. And you can join our conversation about dogs and working dogs and what they do. Our numbers on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You do get into the quality of dog noses. I mean, do we have any idea really what scientifically makes them so much better than ours? It's got to be more than size, right?
We don't. I mean, we have some ideas about what makes them better, and generally we do know that they are better, and it has to do with, you know, what happens once a scent comes in and, you know, how it flows over these areas, and, you know, the length of the dog nose versus ours actually plays a role. And what we don't know is, you know, whether a dog's nose is 100 times or 1,000 times or 10,000 times better than ours. All of those numbers that you hear where people are estimating the dog's nose versus our nose, at this point, we're really making it up. We do know that there are certain chemicals that dogs can detect at parts per billion. And it's also evident that dogs do a heck of a lot better job than we do in finding drugs, finding gas leaks, finding mildew. I mean, the list that of things that dogs are being trained to detect, I think, gets longer every day. But part of that has to do with the fact that dogs are just so good at working with us. Right? They really are an ideal adjunct for sort of extending us, right, out into the world.
And since they're our constant companions, it's easier to delegate the work to them. You point out, though, in the book, though, that there have been some experiments with non-dog animals, and, well, they didn't necessarily go that well.
There were, you know, wherever there are researchers, there's going to be imaginative leaps in trying to figure out, using research money, what the capacities are of other things than dogs. And, of course, machines are one of those things that are ongoing. But there were wonderful experiments during the 60s and 70s, mostly with military research money to study. They studied pigs and skunks and wolves and even tried training rattlesnakes and deer. Deer were had great noses, but as you can imagine, they were terrible at being trained. So some of these critters, like the pig, and we know that pigs are very good at finding truffles in Europe, had fantastic noses. It's simply that thing about how socially acceptable a pig is at your side, working all day as a patrol pig, you know, in a law enforcement department.
I can imagine with a little orange vest and everything. Yes, it might get.
That's exactly right. But they're great. And why the dog ended up being the ideal choice is partly because they're so adaptable. They've co-evolved with us. They're kind of the right size. You can send them anywhere, and people love them. And all of those things together make them the kind of ideal scent animal.
So you talked about the other animals that that were considered, and you detail some of the things that go on at the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. But at what point in history did the use of dogs for these sorts of tasks really take off? Because, as you mentioned, all the way up to mildew dogs, that we have all kinds of specializations for them now. But at what period in history did they begin to get used a lot more for smelling tasks, finding tasks?
It's really clear that the Vietnam era was, and just post-Vietnam was the point in time when researchers really got excited about the dog. And it was the experience of the military dog in Vietnam that got researchers thinking. And that moment when the Vietnam War is winding down and social problems in the United States are winding up, that dogs' capacities started to be of real interest. And, you know, there was research money and the room to experiment. And that was the 60s and 70s were this enormously fertile time. Now, it's true that prior to that, you had law enforcement agencies, right, starting at the turn of the 20th century, that were really starting to use dogs and realize how useful they were. But I think the era of the sniffer dog really took off in the 70s.
Kat Warren's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. Julie in Ashland is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
Good. Hi. This is very interesting. I have a Siberian Husky that's 10 years old, and he's a great sniffer. That's pretty much all he loves to do. And I was wondering two questions. At what age do you usually retire these kinds of dogs, and at what age could a dog like mine take up a second career? And how would I go about initiating the training? I have been his trainer since puppyhood, and he's very smart and very responsive.
All right. Good questions. Thanks for that, Julie.
I mean, those are great questions. And there are a couple of answers. It depends on the dog. 10 is starting to get towards retirement because dogs' noses, like people's noses, do start to suffer little injuries over the course of their lives. And dogs, too, their physical ability, right? You want to be able to have a dog that's willing to go anywhere. And at a certain point, their bodies start to slow down. Solo is still searching. And I've known police dogs to go to the age of 12 and 13, but that's kind of stretching the limits. What I would say about, I do know that there was a marvelous cadaver dog that was a Siberian Husky, a really, really great dog. Huskies have, of course, great noses and great prey drive, a couple of the things that can really help them do this job. What I would say is that there is a great new sport called nose work, and if you just look it up on the web, you have dogs that get trained to find different scents like birch and anise and cinnamon, for instance, and it's called canine nose work, and you're having the dog do the same thing as a drug dog might do or a dog looking for bodies, but they're doing it as a fun sport. And I would say that at the age of 10, you know, it takes a couple of years sometimes to get a dog up and going, and I think it's probably a little late for your dog for that level of work, but for doing this kind of this sport, I think it's never too late to start that.
Yeah, I did find a site here, K9, that's K and the numeral 9, nosework.com, and we'll put that on our Facebook page as well. Are all dogs capable of some scent work, or are some breeds just not particularly good at it, Kat?
Well, there are some breeds that the what you call the brachycephalic dogs, the boxers and the pugs that have very short noses, and it can be a problem for them partly because they get hot and they pant so easily, but that length of nose poses a little more of a challenge to them. But what you're looking at, too, is the dog's willingness to work. So it's not just the nose, it's actually the personality of the dog that goes along with the nose. And you can see if, you know, all of us have probably seen in airports and other places, beagles are a very popular choice for sniffing for agricultural products being brought into the country. The English really love Springer Spaniels for all of this work. I would say that the majority of breeds are capable of this and have just fine noses. And then the question is, what is their capacity in terms of their ability to concentrate and want to please and be sort of driven to do the work. That's kind of the second part.
Much more to talk about how dogs work. The book is What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. Kat Warren wrote it. She's our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Kat and take some more phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is science journalist and university professor Kat Warren. She is teaching science journalism at North Carolina State and is the owner of a cadaver dog, Solo, the German Shepherd. And she tells the exploits of Solo and her training of Solo and her use of Solo out in the field in the book What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs, which expands beyond Solo to a whole profile of many, many dogs in working breeds. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So how is Solo used? I mean, what are the sorts of situations, Kat, in which you get a call asking for the work of you and Solo together?
Well, we're used just by word of mouth, and we don't go out a ton. This is we go out a number of times a year. It really depends. But what will happen is that a law enforcement agency will know about me, usually via word of mouth, and will have heard that I have Solo, or they've used me before, and they'll call and say, usually they say, we have a situation, and we'll explain. And it can be a variety of things. It can be somebody who is lost because of Alzheimer's and, disappeared from a home and hasn't been seen since. It can be a homicide. It can be an accidental death. I write about one case. I'm very careful about the cases that I write about in the book, because most of these cases are law enforcement cases. But in one case, there was a situation where somebody ran from the police during a rainstorm, essentially into a swamp, and didn't come out. And so that was a case where I got the call asking whether I could go and search for this person, because the presumption was he hadn't been heard from for several days, and that he was out there somewhere. And so in those cases, I take Solo. We start a search, and essentially Solo's trained to sort of pick up a whiff of the volatile organic compounds that come off a body, and those can come from a great distance, and they essentially come up and they emit a kind of scent cone, right? And I think we know this ourselves, because we smell scent cones when we come home and walk in the door and something's on the stove, right? But Solo's job is to basically grid back and forth in an area until he can pick up that scent and follow it to its source, which is, one hopes, where the body or whatever remains is there.
You mentioned that you have to be very physically fit yourself, extremely physically fit, I think is what you said. I mean, how hard and long will this work go on? I mean, obviously he's working very hard, and you have to keep up with him too then, right?
Yes, and he's working a lot harder than I am. You do have to be physically fit. I think it's important, but the dog, of course, in sniffing is doing the equivalent of hyperventilating. So, and is quartering back and forth, is doing a lot more ground coverage than you are. And so, to be frank, on a hot summer's day in North Carolina, you can work a dog for 20, 25 minutes, and then you need to put him up and cool him off a little bit and then take him out again. But, you know, I've been on searches that have lasted all day and then started the next day. after resting.
I imagine it's pretty hard to get the dog to rest, though, because they're onto something and they don't particularly want to stop what they're doing, right?
Well, and that's exactly why you have humans who should know better, right? Who can look at all those signs of an exhausted dog and say, you know, because at a certain point, if a dog's tongue is just absolutely hanging out, he's not going to be able to sniff and pant effectively at the same time. So, and their core body temperature goes up, and you can really you can kill a dog in conditions like that. And so it's very important to neither under or overestimate a dog's ability to keep going until it drops.
How do you know when Solo's hit on something? How does he make you aware that he's really close to what it was that you went out to look for in the first place?
He has a bunch of body signals. He's very easy to read, actually, in comparison to my new pup, who is a little more oblique in how she signals. Solo has this tail crick that he gets, which is, I know that sounds very odd, but his tail hooks in a particular way. The way he throws his head, if he is moving in one direction, you'll suddenly see him throw his head and flip and start to move in another direction. And he can be moving pretty fast and not finding anything. And the moment he hits something that is that smell, he will slow down immediately and start working that area. So he gives, you know, sort of a dozen signs of being interested in an area. And it's very clear. The sergeant, the canine sergeant who I trained with for many years and am continuing to train with now that he's in his retirement, said to me at one point, he said, "You can read that dog like a book."
Which is quite a compliment for both of you.
Well, you know, I mean, there are many dogs that are as good or better than Solo that are harder to read. And so it takes a handler simply being able to read that body language. As I said, I mean, it's great that Solo is so obvious because I was at that point kind of illiterate in terms of dog language, right? And Solo's sort of saying everything, but hey, you idiot, it's here. So, really helped me as I was getting up and going.
So the training goes in both directions. He trained you and you trained him, or helped to train him anyway.
Yes. Yeah, no, he did.
The sensitivity of a dog's nose, when there's a great story about how specifically sensitive a cadaver dog's nose can be, and it's the Hamburg experiment. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that was a fascinating experiment, and it came out of a case that I never found out what the outcome of the case was, but basically a husband was suspected of killing his wife and dumping her body off a yacht, and the prosecutor wanted to be able to go ahead and prosecute because some cadaver dogs had indicated on the mattress in the yacht, but the mattress had no blood, no DNA on it. There was no evidence. And so this medical forensic specialist devised an experiment literally where he took a couple of very freshly deceased men who were in their 50s, and within hours of their death he brought them into the hospital and exposed their bodies all wrapped in cloth very briefly to brand new carpet squares. So what you had was the concept of just the scent of death. There was no blood or anything on the carpets, and it was like, two and 10 minutes each exposure to these carpet squares. And then the carpet squares were, you know, popped into containers, and they tested the dogs by giving them a bunch of choices between uncontaminated carpet squares that didn't have the scent of death on them and these carpet squares that were exposed ever so briefly to these wrapped, freshly dead bodies. And the dogs were really two of the three were 100% accurate. It was astonishing that the dogs had no trouble saying a body was pressed briefly on this carpet.
That is just an amazing story, though, and just a true measure of the sensitivity of a cadaver dog's nose. It raises the question, though, about training for you and Solo together. I mean, how gross did things get when he was being taught how to find out what was there?
Well, you know, I don't get grossed out very easily, so I'm actually always happy to consider what kinds of training materials we can use for the dogs. And in North Carolina, we have, of course, we have laws about what can be used, but because I train with a couple different canine units and know a couple different agencies, if there's dirt from underneath the body of somebody who has been missing for a while, and that's pretty redolent dirt, as you can imagine, after a month or so, that is great training material for the dogs. Or teeth. It's legal to have bone, and Solo can detect dry bone, and dried blood, right? So these are the kinds of materials that the dogs need to be exposed to, and we're really fortunate here to have an anthropological research facility up in the mountains that has what's colloquially known as a body farm, where people are put out in the woods and allowed to decompose under a variety of situations to see what happens. And this is for forensic anthropologists to know what happens in those environments.
So not just for dog people, obviously, but for, you know, the for the people who are researching what happens to bodies when
they're decomposing. It is, and it's also very good for dog people because cadaver dogs are allowed to train at that facility, and so both Solo and my new pup Coda have had the opportunity to go up there, and they're worked very carefully, but they're worked inside the body farm, and that is, as you can imagine, a lot of scent, and the dogs need to get used to that because there's a big difference between training on a little bit of sheet that was underneath a body, which the dogs have no trouble finding, and they're being exposed to a whole body. It's kind of like a cloud of scent, and it can be, I hate to say it, sort of discombobulating for a dog that hasn't been exposed to get that much up his nose. And you're talking, as you said, without sounding gross about it, you're talking about everything from a little bit of dry bone or a tooth up to an entire body. And you're asking the dog to understand that all of those things are things that we're looking for.
I'm sure people are going to wonder about the body farm. I assume these are the bodies of people who said, you know, science can have my body when I'm done with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's actually very moving. My trainer, Nancy Hook, wants to donate her body to the University of Tennessee Body Farm. It's one of those real services that people can do. And yes, and these are people who actually like the thought of being out on the side of a hill.
So, even if they're not awake to enjoy it. Go ahead.
No, so I find it humbling because it is a great service, and because all the forensic students learn so much from this experience, and cadaver dog handlers learn a great deal as well. So,
the dogs, and apparently all working dogs are potentially guilty of this. They can become liars if they want the reward. And have you had that issue with Solo in his work?
Sure. I mean, you know, it's called the Clever Hans effect, and this was after this great German draft horse and his math teacher trainer in Germany at the turn of the century, the turn of the last century. And Clever Hans was this horse that could do math, and he would paw his hoof when the, you know, his owner would ask him what's, you know, 8 × 3 − 5, and the horse would paw out the answer, and everybody was just amazed. And of course, what they learned is that the owner was giving even to him just subconscious signals so that the horse got the answer not through doing the math, not through being a math genius, but by reading his owner's body language incredibly well. And, of course, dogs co-evolved with us, and they read our body language. So the issue of a dog saying that something is there when it's not there so that he can get rewarded is called a false alert, and serious handlers and trainers are always working to make sure that that doesn't happen. Dogs cheat. I mean, the notion that a dog would never lie is really so silly. It's sort of like people lie. Dogs co-evolved with us. They learn to lie.
They learn to lie, too. All right.
Well, you know, the dog that says at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm hungry, I'm really hungry.
Yes, we've noticed that. Our dog, in fact, does it exactly at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when he knows he doesn't get fed until 4:30.
That's right, and he's probably not all that hungry.
Oh, that's good to know, too.
I'm a little hungry. Maybe if I look like I'm starving, they'll do something about it.
Right, I can nudge the schedule up a little bit. Well, we've learned a lot from What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs. Kat Warren wrote it. She's been our guest on The Exchange. Kat, thank you.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the influenza outbreak in our region and what's going on with that. We'll also talk about a difference in the way that poverty levels are calculated for school districts and what it might mean in difference in earnings for those school districts. And then at 9 o'clock tomorrow, we'll talk about riverkeeper programs and what they do in our rivers in the region. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and the person at the controls today, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of The Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.